Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. There's a lot of discussions these days about hope in this time of the pending election for president. Frances Moore LePay, author of A Diet for a Small Planet, discusses the need to give up some old assumptions in order to create hope in her new book, Getting a Grip: Clarity, Creativity, and Courage in a World Gone Mad. She says that one path to hope is abandoning old assumptions, and that comes from curiosity, which is also a guiding principle for Radio Curious. When I visited with Frances Moore LePay on February 20th, 2008, from her office in Cambridge, Massachusetts, we discussed curiosity and her reflection that she should have included curiosity in the title of Getting a Grip. And we began when I asked her about curiosity.
Well, curiosity served me well, and fortunately, I think we are by nature curious, and it is curiosity, in one sense, that just kept me asking the next question throughout my life. And somebody once asked me, in an interview maybe 10, 15 years ago, you know, what are you most proud of in your life? And, besides my wonderful children, Anna and Anthony, my great pride in them, I think what I'm most proud of is that I've continued to follow my curiosity to take me to the next layer and the next layer and the next layer, and hopefully that will never end. So for me, this is the great blessing and the great, you know, the great heartache if people feel that they have to block their curiosity and just stick within a dogma that has been inherited by them.
What is the genesis of the curiosity that drew you to write Getting a Grip?
Well, it really, in some sense, goes way back to my early 60s experience as a community organizer. And I was in the mid-60s, I was an organizer for the Welfare Rights Organization in Philadelphia, and the woman who I worked most closely with died of a heart attack as a very young woman, and I was convinced that she didn't die of a heart attack at all. She really died of poverty, but I didn't know how what I was doing addressed the roots of her death. And I then said, wait a minute, a couple years later, when I was then in California in a graduate program in community organizing, I said, wait a minute, I've got to know how what I'm doing relates to the causes of Lily's death. And that's what led me out of graduate school, in a sense, into my own, to listen to my own questions, to follow my own curiosity. And it's that, then, asking why hunger, and then the next question, why hunger in a world of plenty, and then the next question, why are we, this intelligent species, creating a world that none of us as individuals want, you know, and on and on. And so that last question really led me then to realize that the answer, at least my working hypothesis today, is that the answer to that last question, why are we creating a world that we as individuals abhor, is that we human beings are creatures of the mind, that ideas are more powerful than instincts, and we have some really dangerous ideas that have their grip on us right now.
And those ideas are?
Well, the central idea of the culture that I grew up in, live within, that is now going global, is a culture based on lack and therefore fear, based on scarcity and therefore fear. And I, if you open my book, Getting a Grip, you see right there inside the front cover, you pull the flap back, and there it is, the spiral of powerlessness that is premised on there not being enough, not being enough goods, and that's my shorthand for everything from energy to food, to, you know, parking places, to love, right? There's not enough of anything. And then not enough goodness in us, human beings, that we, you know, peeling away the fluff, all we really are selfish, competitive materialists. Well, from that premise, we are done in, because that leads to a spiral of causation, which I then schematize in that graphic, that leaves us powerless. And I argue that that is the only real problem today, is our feeling of powerlessness, because solutions are known to all our terrible problems. It's just that we feel powerless to address them.
It seems to me that there may be a jump there that I'd like to ask you about. The jump to powerlessness from a place of survival. There isn't enough now if we gather it as our species were hunter-gatherers eons ago. We would gather things in the summer for the cold winter. That allowed a certain amount of power, and it allowed for survival.
Right. But first of all, we didn't have the capacity then as we do now to transform our desire for, understandably and certainly naturally, our desire for survival and feeding ourselves and feeding our offspring. Unfortunately, today, that process of meeting our needs is actually creating scarcity, actually destroying, disrupting, and destroying the Earth's productive capacities. That was not possible when we were hunter-gatherers, or at least it was much less possible. I mean, we did, as I understand it, I'm not an expert at all in this history, but I do understand that, you know, even with the tools we had then, we caused some havoc. But the point is that today, just for brevity, I left out many steps there in my spiral of powerlessness, but I'm arguing that starting from the premise of lack, a lack of goodness in us, lack of capacity to come together to solve problems that are in the interest of all of us, that we feel we have to turn over our fate to some automatic, infallible law. And unfortunately, many think they have found it in the magic of the market, to use Ronald Reagan's term. Now, this magical market that people believe somehow is going to solve our problems, it is based in one rule. That is highest return to existing wealth, highest return to those who already have the shares in companies, and therefore inexorably concentrates wealth and power so much that it infuses and infects our political decision-making and ends up then creating scarcity. And obviously this is a longer argument in my book, but the basic idea is that once we perceive ourselves as incapable of genuine democracy, of deliberating together over what is best for ourselves and our planet, then we are apt to, and we are today, turning our fate over to that which, in the case of the one-rule economy, that which is actually destroying our security, because it is, in the case of food, for example, you probably may remember from Diet for Small Planet, we are taking 16 pounds of grain and soy to produce 1 pound of beef in this country, and tens of, you know, maybe 10,000-15,000 gallons of water to produce that same pound of beef.
Well, I would argue that much of this changed the way our species live at the onset of the industrial age, when a person's ability to provide for themselves and their family was taken over by industry, so that people could go somewhere to obtain food and to obtain clothing. And that was about 150 years ago. Little more. So now very few people can provide for their own food. Very few people can make their own clothes. In fact, I don't think home economics and clothes making is taught in the high schools very much anymore. So we become wholly dependent, to the extent that somebody mentioned to me the other day, that's got me thinking, if the electricity in the United States were turned off, half of the population would probably be dead in about 30 days. Hmm. Remember that water is pumped by electricity.
Yes, yes. No, I think there's a lot of truth in that angle, coming at it from that angle in terms of our powerlessness. If we do not know how to provide these very basic needs on our own. But I would argue also that it's, yes, the Industrial Revolution, but of a certain type. Certainly one can imagine that if we had not gone the fossil fuel route, which I think, you know, by its very nature, by its being very costly to extract and only in a few places, that it leads to the concentration of power that then disempowers those all the rest of us to for self-provisioning of the kind that you're talking about. So, you know, I think it is, yes, the Industrial Revolution within with fossil fuel driven, and coupled with this very limited view of the market, that the market can only run by one rule, that is highest return to those who already have wealth, and not therefore embedded in community where the market had evolved as just one aspect of life. It then became the dominant driver of life. And that's what I say are the dangerous ideas that we can now free ourselves from. The idea is more powerful than instincts.
I see the aspect of television as being the dominant driver of marketing life. Do you have some thoughts on where that dominance or that drive is in our society?
Well, I think advertising overall, and certainly television, is still perhaps the most powerful way to capture our minds and to make us believe, certainly to make us feel insecure, to make us feel fearful that we don't have what we need to be loved and in strong communities and contributors, because the advertising is continually telling us that we are inadequate and that we must purchase in order to be accepted. So I think that is part of exactly what I'm talking about here, is the fear at the very, you know, at the very center of the spiral that's taking us down. This premise of lack is reinforced, the lack in ourselves is reinforced every day if we watch television advertising.
Frances Moore LePay, I'd like to talk with you about the power of simply listening, but before we do that, I'd like to say that in this edition of Radio Curious, we are talking with Frances Moore LePay, the author of Getting a Grip, Clarity, Creativity, and Courage in a World Gone Mad. You're listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Frances Moore LePay, the concept of simply listening is a little different in radio than it is in television. In radio, we provide the voice and the concepts. In television, the voice and the concepts are delineated into pictures. When you address the power of simply listening, what are you saying?
Well, that is part of a whole piece of my approach in Getting a Grip. So active listening, the power of simply listening, is part of what I call the arts of democracy. So it's embedded in this shift of frame from democracy as something that is done to us or for us, something that we inherit, something that can be reduced simply to elections plus a market. And I'm arguing, no, that can never work, and that actually something more powerful is emerging that I call living democracy, which is understanding democracy as a culture of empowerment. And because we can have all those trappings of democracy in terms of elections and markets, et cetera, and still have most people living in misery. So clearly, democracy is not made simply by those formal institutions. So one art of democracy, I argue, one primary one, is active listening. And I believe that thinking of it as an art is critical because, you know, we understand that we're naturally social beings. Human beings are. We evolved in tribes. But being skillful, being effective, being powerful in democratic culture is a skill that we can learn. It's an art that we can learn. And so I talk about things, for example, in mediation that little kids now are learning in school. That's not just that it definitely involves active listening, because the mediator has to listen and truly identify with all parties concerned. That is an exercise in active listening, and I argue that that's not some specialized training to make our kids better. You know, that is critical to democracy itself, because anyone who has that kind of skill is not likely then to be just a follower or to feel powerless and just go along with the pack.
Tell us more about active listening. How can someone listening to this program, for example, be an active listener?
Well, I typically use it in a different way. I mean, it's about face-to-face meetings and deliberations over what we care about. But I think the obvious application to radio would be to be a respondent and to really listen with constantly checking whether or not what you're hearing registers true with you, and how does it stimulate your curiosity? How does this conversation that people are listening to now, what does that make you curious about, and to follow that curiosity? Because I believe that that is the basis of our being able to break free of the fear trap, because I often quote a wonderful historian in Oxford who said that curiosity is the greatest antidote to fear, because as we follow our curiosity, we just, you know, you just have to get at the root, and therefore you aren't intimidated, you know, to call in the station or to talk to your neighbors or to join up with something that you've heard about. So I think applying that term to listening to radio, it would have to do with being actively engaged and not simply thinking that you're being entertained by what somebody else says, but how does this relate to me and what does it provoke in me that I can then pursue?
Well, what it provokes in the listener and breaking free of the fear trap has an assumption, I believe, that a person is aware that they're afraid. It's within their thinking structure.
Well, yes, but I think that all of us are aware, most of us are aware, I should say, you know, that we hesitate. You know, we get an idea, but then we pull back. And that is a very low-grade, if you will, fear. We don't necessarily have those typical fear sensations, but it's a hesitancy to move into the unknown, to pick up the phone or to talk to someone about something that really matters to us that we've never done before. So really, it's there's another chapter in my book about fear. And here I talk very much about what we're talking about now. As I learned from an extraordinary moment when I was in Kenya with my daughter, I learned to rethink fear as pure energy, as information, not as something telling me that I'm in the wrong place, wrong time, you know, and I should either freeze, flee, or fight. It is just as important to rethink fear as it is to rethink democracy, and I think in many ways fear is an idea.
Tell us more how fear is an idea.
Well, I the way I think of it is that we evolved in tightly knit tribes understanding two things about fear. Separating from the pack was very scary because our survival depended on staying with the pack or the tribe, if you will. And we also learned that we could trust those sensations, those bodily sensations. I mean, when we saw the lion coming, you know, and we learned that the body's reactions of flee or fight or maybe freeze, you know, that these were life-saving and we could trust those body sensations. But the thing is, we have to realize that we still have a lot of that hard wiring within us in the early 21st century when the entire hyper tribe, as I like to think of it, is headed over Victoria Falls. And so separating from the tribe takes on a whole new meaning. It's not death, it's life. It's life for ourselves and others on this precious planet. We still have those body sensations that are hardwired in us, even when we are doing the life-serving thing. When we are separating and saying something unpopular or stepping into our discomfort zone, which is often just the unknown itself to most of us, is uncomfortable. And I think we evolved not to be comfortable in the unknown because there might be a predator lurking, right? But to be truly alive and to be truly joyful in this moment in the 21st century, we have to just recognize, yeah, we're hardwired to be uncomfortable if we're trying out the unknown and risking separating from others who we care about. But that is the way forward, and it does not have to stop us. It can actually be information telling us we are just doing what we should be. And so, and what is going to give us life and others life. So I have a sort of cheesy trick that I devised for myself a couple of years ago, and that is simply that when I feel that pounding heart, which is my primary first reaction when I'm feeling uncomfortable, when I'm feeling a risk of humiliation. I get a pounding heart. So I've started renaming that inner applause, telling myself, no, it's not that you're a wimp. It's that you're exactly, you know, you're going for it and just keep going. And it worked for me.
One of the things that came to mind when I read Getting a Grip is that perhaps it is a book that is focused towards people who understand that there are problems in our society, who understand that they are in a comfort zone and out of the comfort zone is the unknown. So my question is, how do you make these concepts and this book available to people who don't know that a grip should be gotten?
Well, I guess, Barry, I think that most people know we are in deep, deep trouble. And I think, you know, there's more and more sense of that in this country and elsewhere, whether we're talking about heating our planet or we're talking about the economic crisis here, the increasing poverty. I start with, I think, a very well-founded assumption that most people recognize that we are in deep trouble and they don't know what to do. And if they do something, it can often feel what I call a random act of sanity, you know, an act of protest or act of charity, but not connected to any sense that one is actually getting at the root of the problem in a way that is effective in the time that we have to make this great shift. So that's why I wrote the book, is to help myself as I was writing it, because that's how I think and get clear, and hopefully readers to see that there is a pattern here. We can identify root causes and to shift the frame toward power so that we look at it through how do we build democratic power as the fundamental challenge of our time. So I guess I disagree with your questions. Sure, there are always a minority of people who have their heads in the sand, I guess you could say. But I don't worry about that. I worry about the vast majority who are concerned but feel powerless.
Well, let me ask this. If we don't get a grip, how do you see our American society in 30 years, 40 years?
I see it very much as we see in so many countries in the global South today. We're headed right in that direction. Many of your readers may know that we are already the most class-divided of all the industrial countries, and we already provide drastically less in terms of freedom protections, in terms of basic protections against illness and that other industrial societies provide. So I see that unless we make this turn, that we will be very much like we see many countries in the global South today, extremely class-divided, people living in a great deal of fear and just trying to survive, and greater and greater pollution and greater division of more and more living behind the, you know, behind the walls, like we think of Latin America, where the elite live, fearful of being kidnapped behind walls with grates and spikes so that people won't climb over them. So that's the world that I see us moving toward unless we can make this democratic revolution.
So that's a turn in one direction, but it seems in some ways the concept of no child left behind, for example, is a turn in the other direction.
Most of my book, I really want to make clear, most of my book is, as my last four or five books have been, about what is emerging that is a new way of thinking and being in democracy that is, I believe, our best chance to make this turn toward life. And I call it living democracy, and it really is a shift from this simple democracy as structure inherited and fixed to democracy as a journey that is life-giving in the process and that has the potential to take advantage of the end of oil and to decentralize energy production and use and to allow us all to engage in practice, learning and practicing the arts of democracy to live more rewarding lives. So that's the other direction, and it is emerging in cultures all over the world, in pockets large and small, here and elsewhere. But I write this book because I believe so strongly that human beings are social mimics. In fact, you know, there's more neuroscience behind that now than ever before, that we take our cues from one another. We're actually experiencing as we observe others, we actually experience what we're observing in our own brain cells. So I write and I speak and make video. We have several mini documentaries now that my son has made for, my son Anthony LePay has made for Small Planet Institute, you know, really to show living democracy emerging, whether it be kids doing democracy in their public schools and being problem solvers in their communities and really learning these skills from an early age, or whether it be, you know, getting money out of the political system as a sine qua non of a genuine democracy.
Well, Frances Moore LePay, author of Getting a Grip, Clarity, Creativity, and Courage in a World Gone Mad, I want to thank you for being with us on Radio Curious. And before we close, I have a couple of questions. And the first one is, in the past year or so, what is the most important thing you have learned?
I've learned that particularly young people are really hungry for something that they can do, meaning in their lives. I would say this young people in the 18 to 30 category, this is what is so rewarding for me, so exciting. This is a real can-do generation. They want to get involved, and I'm just thrilled with that. So that's what keeps me going these days, is that sense of connecting with this younger generation.
And the other question is, can you tell us of an interesting book that you've read lately?
Oh, I just started last night. It's an amazing book that so confirms everything. It's called The Field, and it's written by a writer, but it's based on physics, about how what the state of the art in physics is telling us about our interconnectedness beyond at the most basic molecular level. And so it really reinforces at a deep science level everything that I'm saying about living democracy and how we create our reality together moment to moment. And so therefore it really reinforces my mantra in the book, saying that we don't have a choice of whether or not to change the world. The only choice we have is how we change the world, because we are so connected that each of our actions and even our attitudes are shaping our reality moment to moment.
Well, Frances Moore LePay, thank you for being with us on Radio Curious.
My great pleasure. Thank you.
Frances Moore LePay is the author of Getting a Grip, Clarity, Creativity, and Courage in a World Gone Mad. The book she recommends is The Field, The Quest for the Secret Force of the Universe by Lynn McTaggart. This interview with Frances Moore LePay was recorded on February 20th, 2008. Copies of this and other editions of Radio Curious can be found on our website, www.radiocurious.org. They're also available in CD format for $10 each. At Radio Curious, we appreciate your thoughts and ideas about our programming and enjoy hearing from you. Our address is Post Office Box 7, Ukiah, that's UKIAH, California, 95482. Our email address is curious@radiocurious.org. And the phone is 707-462-6541. You've been listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Thank you for joining us.